the rolling sand grains were stilled.
"This is how it looked 20 minutes ago," said Rinpo. "See the blue-white dot there, and then it spreads."
"I know what I'm looking at," said Lutze grimly. "I was there when it happened, remember? Your reverence, get them to run the old glass clock sequence. We haven't got a lot of time."
"I really think we..." the acolyte began, but he was interrupted by a blow from a rubber brick.
"Wanna putty wanna... If Lutze is right, then we must not waste time, gentlemen. And if he is wrong, then we have time to spare. Is this not so? Putty now, wanna wanna wanna..."
"Thank you," said the sweeper. He cupped his hands.
"Oi, you lot. Spindle two, fourth bring, around about the 19th grupa, and jump to it."
"I really must respectfully protest, your reverence," said the acolyte. "We have practiced for just such an emergency as..."
"Yeah, I know all about practicing procedures for emergency," said Lutze. "And there's always something missing."
"Ridiculous. We take great pains to..."
"You always leave out the damn emergency."
Lutze turned back to the hall and the apprehensive workers.
"Ready? Good. Put it on the floor now, or I shall have to come down there, and I don't want to have to come down there."
There was some frantic activity by men around the cylinders, and a new pattern replaced the one below the balcony. The lines and colours were in different places, but a blue-white circle occupied the centre.
"There," said Lutze. "That was less than 10 days before the clock struck."
There was silence from the monks.
Lutze smiled grimly.
"And 10 days later..."
"Time stopped," said Lobsang.
"That's one way of putting it," said Lutze.
He'd gone red in the face. One of the monks put a hand on his shoulder.
"It's all right, Huswepa," he said soothingly. "We know you couldn't have got there in time."
"Being in time is supposed to be what we do," said Lutze. "I was nearly at the damn door, Charlie. Too many castles, not enough time."
Behind him, the mandala returned to its slow metering of the present.
"It wasn't your fault," said the monk.
Lutze shook the hand free and turned to face the abbot over the shoulder of the chief acolyte.
"I want permission to track this one down right now, reverend sir," he said.
He tapped his nose.
"I've got the smell of it. I've been waiting for this all these years. You won't find me wanting this time."
In the silence, the abbot blew a bubble.
"It'll be an Uberfout again," said Lutze,
a hint of pleading in his voice.
"That's where they mess around with the electric. I know every inch of that place. Give me a couple of men and we can nip this right in the bud."
"Bab, bab, 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 this needs discussion, Lutze, but we thank you for your offer, bab, 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 bab," said the abbot.
"Rinpo, I want all badum, dum, badum, senior field monks in the room of silence within 5 bab, bab, bab minutes. Are the spinners working badum, badum, harmoniously?"
One of the monks looked up from the scroll he'd been handed.
"It appears so, your reverence. My congratulations to the board master.
Pick it!"
"But Shoblang is dead," muttered Lutze.
The abbot stopped blowing bubbles.
"That is sad news. And he was a friend of yours, I understand."
"Shouldn't have happened like that,"
the sweeper muttered.
"Shouldn't have happened like that. Compose yourself, Lutze. I will talk to you shortly.
Pick it!"
The chief acolyte, spurred on by a blow across the ear with a rubber monkey, hurried away. The press of monks began to thin out as they went about their duties. Lutze and Lobsang were left on the balcony, looking down at the rippling mandala. Lutze cleared his throat.
"See them spinners at the end," he said. "The little one records the patterns for a day, and then anything interesting is stored in the big ones."
"I just premembered that you were going to say that."
"Good word, good word. The lad has talent."
Lutze lowered his voice.
"Anyone watching us?"
Lobsang looked round. "There's a few people still here." Lutze raised his voice again.
"You been taught anything about the big crash?"
"Only rumours, sweeper."
"Yeah, there were a lot of rumours. The day, time stood still, all that sort of thing."
Lutze sighed.
"You know, most of what you get taught is lies. It has to be. Sometimes, if you get the truth all at once, you can't understand it. You knew Ankh-Morpork pretty well, did you? Ever go to the opera house?"
"Only for pickpocket practice, sweeper."
"Ever wonder about it? Ever look at that little theatre just over the road called the Disc, I think?"
"Oh, yes, we got penny tickets and sat on the ground and threw nuts at the stage."
"And it didn't make you think? Big opera house, all plush and gilt and big orchestras. And then there's this little thatch theatre, all bare wood and no seats, and one bloke playing a crumb horn for musical accompaniment."
Lobsang shrugged. "Well, no. That's just how things are."
Lutse almost smiled.
"Very flexible things, human minds," he said. "It's amazing what they can stretch to fit. We did a fine job there."
"Lutse?"
One of the lesser acolytes was waiting respectfully.
"The abbot will see you now," he said.
"All right," said the sweeper.
He nudged Lobsang and whispered,
"We're going to hang more pork, lad."
"What? But you said you wanted to be sent to..." Lutse winked.
"'Cause it is written, them as asks don't get, see? There's more than one way of choking a dang-dang than stuffing it with pling, lad."
"Is there?"
"Oh, yes. If you've got enough pling. Now, let's see the abbot, shall we? It'll be time for his feed now, solids, thank goodness. At least he's done with the wet nurse. It was so embarrassing for him and the young lady. Honestly, you didn't know where to put your face, and neither did he. I mean, mentally, he's 900 years old.
That must make him very wise."
Pretty wise, pretty wise. But age and wisdom don't necessarily go together, I've always found," said Lutse, as they approached the abbot's rooms. "Some people just become stupid with more authority. Not his reverence, of course."
The abbot was in his high chair, and had recently flicked a spoonful of nourishing pap all over the chief acolyte, who was smiling, like a man whose job depended on looking happy that parsnip and gooseberry custard was dribbling down his forehead. It occurred to Lobsang, not for the first time, that the abbot was a little bit more than purely random in his attacks on the man. The acolyte was, indeed, the kind of mildly objectionable person who engendered an irresistible urge in any right-thinking person to pour goo into his hair and hit him with rubber yak. And the abbot was old enough to listen to his inner child.
"You sent for me, your reverence?" said Lutse, bowing.
The abbot upturned his bowl down the chief acolyte's robe.
Yes, Lutse, how old are you now?"
800, your reverence, but that's no age at all."
"Nevertheless, you have spent a lot of time in the world. I understood you were looking to retire and cultivate your gardens."
"Yes, but..."
"But,"
the abbot smiled angelically,
"like an old warhorse, you say, ha-ha, at the sound of trumpets, yes?"
"I don't think so," said Lutse. "There's nothing funny about trumpets, really."
"I meant that you long to be out in the field again. But you have been helping to train world operatives for many years, haven't you? Of these gentlemen?"
A number of burly and muscular monks were sitting on one side of the room. They were kitted out for travel with rolled sleeping mats on their backs and dressed in loose black clothing. They nodded sheepishly at Lutse, and their eyes above their half-masks looked embarrassed.
"I did my best," said Lutse. "Of course, others trained them. I just tried to undo the damage. I never taught them to be ninjas,"
he nudged Lobsang.
"That apprentice is Agatean for the passing wind," he said in a stage whisper. "I am proposing to send them out immediately." "Rah!"
The abbot hit his high chair with his spoon.
"That is my order, Lutse. You are a legend, but you have been a legend for a long time. Why not trust in the future?"
"Bicket!"
"I see," said Lutse sadly. "Oh, well, it had to happen sometime. Thank you for your consideration, your reverence." "Brrm, brrm. Lutse, I have known you a long time. You will not go within 100 miles of Oberwald, will you?"
"Not at all, your reverence."
"That is an order." "I understand, of course. You've disobeyed my orders before, though. In Omnia, I remember."
"Tactical decision made by the man on the spot, your reverence. It was more what you might call an interpretation of your order," said Lutse.
"You mean going where you had distinctly been told not to go, and doing what you were absolutely forbidden to do?"
"Yes, your reverence.
Sometimes you have to move the seesaw by pushing the other end. When I did what shouldn't be done in a place where I shouldn't have been, I achieved what needed to be done in a place where it should have happened."
The abbot gave Lutse a long, hard stare, the kind that babies are good at giving.
"Lutse, you are not to go to Oberwald or anywhere near Oberwald, understand?" he said.
"I do, your reverence, you are right, of course. But in my dotage, may I travel another path of wisdom rather than violence? I wish to show this young man the way."
There was laughter from the other monks.
"The way of the washerwoman?" said Rinpo.
"Mrs. Cosmopolite is a dressmaker," said Lutse calmly, "whose wisdom is in sayings like, 'It won't get better if you pick it,'" said Rinpo, winking at the rest of the monks.
"Few things get better if you pick at them," said Lutse.
And now his calmness was a leak of tranquillity,
It may be a mean little way, but small and unworthy though it is my way."
He turned to the abbot.
"That was how it used to be, Your Reverence, you recall? Master and pupil go out into the world, where the pupil may pick up practical instruction by precept and example, and then a pupil finds his own way, and at the end of his way, he finds himself."
"Burdum,"
said the abbot.
"First, he finds a teacher," said Lutze. "He is lucky that you will burdum be that teacher."
"Reverend sir," said Lutze, "it is in the nature of ways that none can be sure who the teacher may be. All I can do is show him a path,
which will be in the direction of Burdum, the city," said the abbot.
"Yes," said Lutze, "and Ankh-Morpork is a long way from Uberwald. You won't send me to Uberwald, because I am an old man, so, in all respect, I beg you to humour an old man."
"I have no choice, when you put it like that," said the abbot.
"Reverend sir," began Rin Po, who felt that he did. The spoon was banged on the tray again.
"Let's say, as a man of high reputation," the abbot shouted, "I trust him implicitly to do the correct action. I just wish I could trust him to do what I want. I have forbidden him to go to Uberwald. Now do you wish me to forbid him not to go to Uberwald? Be it. I have spoken. And now, will all you gentlemen be so good as to leave? I have urgent business to attend to."
Lutze bowed and grabbed Lobsang's arm.
"Come on, lad," he whispered. "Let's bugger off quick before anyone works it out."
On the way out, they passed a lesser acolyte carrying a small potty with a pattern of bunny rabbits around it.
"It's not easy reincarnating," said Lutze, running down the corridor. "Now, we've got to be out of here before someone gets any funny ideas, lad. Grab your bag and bedroll."
"But no one would countermand the abbot's orders, would they?" said Lobsang as they skidded around a corner.
"Ha! It'll be his nap in 10 minutes, and if they give him a new toy when he wakes up, he might end up being so busy banging square green pegs into round blue holes, he'll forget what he said," said Lutze. "Politics, lad. Too many idiots will start saying what they're sure the abbot would have meant. Off you go now. I'll see you in the Garden of Five Surprises in 1 minute."
When Lobsang arrived, Lutze was carefully tying one of the bonsai mountains into a bamboo framework. He fastened the last knot and placed it in a bag over one shoulder.
"Won't it get damaged?" said Lobsang. "It's a mountain. How can it get damaged?"
Lutze picked up his broom.
"And we'll just drop in and have a chat with an old mate of mine before we leave, though. Maybe we'll pick up some stuff."
"What's going on, sweeper?" said Lobsang, treading after him.
"Well, it's like this, lad. Me and the abbot and the bloke we're going to see, we go back a long way. Things are a bit different now. The abbot can't just say, 'Lutze, you are an old rogue. It was you who put the idea of Uberwald into everyone's heads in the first place, but I see you're onto something, so off you go and follow your nose.'"
"But I thought he was the supreme ruler."
"Exactly. And it's very hard to get things done when you're a supreme ruler. There are too many people in the way, mucking things up. This way, the new lads can have fun running around Uberwald going, 'Hi!' And we, my lad, will be heading for Ankh-Morpork. The abbot knows that. Almost knows that."
"How do you know the new clock is being built in Ankh-Morpork?" said Lobsang, trailing behind Lutze as he took a mossy, sunken path that led through rhododendron thickets to the monastery wall.
"I know. I'll tell you, the day someone pulls the plug out of the bottom of the universe, the chain will lead all the way to Ankh-Morpork and some bugger saying, 'I just want to see what would happen.' All roads lead to Ankh-Morpork."
"I thought all roads led away from Ankh-Morpork."
"Not the way we're going. Ah, here we are."
Lutze knocked on the door of a rough but large shed built right up against the wall. At the same moment, there was an explosion within, and someone, Lobsang corrected himself, half of someone, tumbled very fast out of the unglazed window beside it and hit the path with bone-cracking force. Only when it stopped rolling did he realise it was a wooden dummy in a monk's robe.
"Cow's having fun, I see," said Lutze.
He hadn't moved as the dummy had sailed past his ear. The door burst open, and a plump old monk looked out excitedly.
"Did you see that? Did you see that?" he said. "And that was with just one spoonful."
He nodded at them.
"Oh, hello, Lutze. I was expecting you. I've got some things ready."
"Got what?" said Lobsang.
"Who's the boy?"
said Q, ushering them in.
"The untutored child is called Lobsang," said Lutze, looking around the shed.
There was a smoking circle on the stone floor, with drifts of blackened sand around it.
"New toys, Q?"
"Exploding mandala," said Q happily, bustling forward.
Just sprinkle a special sand on the simple design any way you like, and the first enemy to walk on it, bang, instant karma. Don't touch that!
Lu Tsei reached across and snatched from Lobsang's inquisitive hands the begging bowl that he had just picked up from a table.
Remember rule one, he said, and hurled the bowl across the room.
Hidden blades slid out as it spun, and the bowl buried itself in a beam.
That would take a man's head right off, said Lobsang.
And then they heard the faint ticking.
Three, four, five, said Q. Everyone duck now!
Lu Tsei pushed Lobsang to the floor a moment before the bowl exploded. Metal fragments scythed overhead.
I added just little something extra since you last saw it, said Q proudly, as they got to their feet again. A very versatile device. Plus, of course, you can use it to eat rice out of. Oh, and have you seen this?
He picked up a prayer drum. Both Lu Tsei and Lobsang took a step back. Q twirled the drum a few times, and the weighted cords pattered against the skins.
The cord can be instantly removed for a handy garrote, he said, and the drum itself can be removed, like so, to reveal this useful dagger.
Plus, of course, you could use it to pray with, said Lobsang.
Well spotted, said Q. Quick, boy! A prayer is always useful in the last resort. In fact, we've been working on a very promising mantra incorporating sonic tones that have a particular effect on the human nervous system.
I don't think we need any of this stuff, Q, said Lu Tsei.
Q sighed. At least you could let us turn your brew into a secret weapon, Lu Tsei. I've shown you the plans.
It is a secret weapon, said Lu Tsei. It's a broom.
How about the new yaks we've been breeding? At the touch of a rein, their horns will instantly...
We want the spinners, Q.
The monk suddenly looked guilty.
Spinners? What? Spinners.
Lu Tsei walked across the room and pressed a hand against part of the wall, which slid aside.
These spinners, Q, don't muck me about. We haven't got time.
Lobsang saw what looks very much like two small procrastinators, each one within a metal framework mounted on a board. There was a harness attached to each board.
You haven't told the abbot about them yet, have you?
Said Lu Tsei, unhooking one of the things.
He'd put a stop to them if you did, you know that.
I didn't think anyone knew, said Q. How did you?
Lu Tsei grinned.
No one notices a sweeper, he said.
They're still very experimental, said Q, close to panic. I was going to tell the abbot, of course, but I was waiting until I had something to demonstrate, and it would be terrible if they fell into the wrong hands.
Then we'll see to it they don't, said Lu Tsei, examining the straps. How are they powered now?
Weights and ratchets were too unreliable, said Q. I'm afraid I had to resort to clockwork.
Lu Tsei stiffened, and he glared at the monk.
Clockwork? Only as a motive force, only as a motive force, Q protested. There's really no other choice.
Too late now. It'll have to do, said Lu Tsei,
unhooking the other board and passing it across to Lobsang.
There you go, lad. With a bit of sacking round it, it'll look just like a backpack.
What is it?
Q sighed.
They're portable procrastinators. Try not to break them, please.
What will we need them for? I hope we don't have to find out, said Lu Tsei. Thanks, Q.
Are you sure you wouldn't prefer some time bombs? Said Q, hopefully. Drop one on the floor, and time will slow for...
Thanks, but no.
The other monks were fully equipped, said Q.
But we're travelling light, said Lu Tsei firmly. We'll go out the back way, Q, okay?
The back way led to a narrow path and a small gate in the wall. Dismembered wooden dummies and patches of scorched rock indicated that Q and his assistants often came this way. And then there was another path beside one of the many icy streamlets.
Q means well, said Lu Tsei, walking fast, but if you listen to him, you end up clanking when you walk and exploding when you sit down.
Lobsang ran to keep up.
It'll take weeks to walk to Ankh Morpork, sweeper. We'll slice our way there, said Lu Tsei,
and he stopped and turned.
You think you can do that?
I've done it hundreds of times, Lobsang began.
In Oi Dong, yes, said Lu Tsei, but there are all kinds of checks and safeguards in the valley.
Oh, didn't you know that?
Slicing in Oi Dong is easy, lad. It's different out there. The air tries to get in the way. Do it wrong and the air is as a rock. You have to shape the slice around you so that you move like a fish in water. Know how to do that?
We learned a bit of the theory, but
Sotal said you stopped time for yourself back in the city. The Stance of the Coyote, it's called. Very hard to do. And I don't reckon they teach it in the Thieves Guild, eh?
I suppose I was lucky, sweeper.
Good. Keep it up. We'll have plenty of time for you to practice before we leave the snow. Get it right before you tread on grass or kiss your feet goodbye.
They called it slicing time. There is a way of playing certain musical instruments that is called circular breathing, devised to allow people to play the didgeridoo or the bagpipes without actually imploding or being sucked down the tube. Slicing time was very much the same, except time was substituted for air, and it was a lot quieter. A trained monk could stretch a second further than an hour. But that wasn't enough. He'd be moving in a rigid world. He'd have to learn to see by echolight, and hear by ghost sound, and let time leech into his immediate universe. It wasn't hard once he found the confidence. The sliced world could almost seem normal, apart from the colours. It was like walking in sunsets. Although the sun was fixed high in the sky and barely moved, the world ahead shaded towards violet, and the world behind, when Lobsang looked round, was the shade of old blood. And it was lonely. But the worst of it, Lobsang realised, was the silence. There was noise of a sort, but it was just a deep sizzle at the edge of hearing. His footsteps sounded strange and muffled, and the sound arrived in his ears out of sync with the tread of his feet. They reached the edge of the valley and stepped out of the perpetual springtime into the real world of the snows. Now the cold crept in slowly like a sadist's knife. Lutse strode on ahead, seemingly oblivious to it. Of course, that was one of the stories about him. Lutse, it was said, would walk for miles during weather when the clouds themselves would freeze and crash out of the sky. Cold did not affect him, they said. And yet, in the stories, Lutse had been bigger, stronger, not a skinny little bald man who preferred not to fight. Sweeper! Lutse stopped and turned. His outline blurred slightly, and Lobsang unwrapped himself from time. Colour came back into the world, and while the cold ceased to have the force of a drill, it still struck hard.
Yes, lad? You're going to teach me, right? If there's anything left you don't know, Wonder Boy, said Lutse dryly. You're slicing well, I can see that.
I don't know how you can stand this cold.
Ah, you don't know the secret.
Is it the way of Mrs. Cosmopolite that gives you such power? Lutse hitched up his robe and did a little dance in the snow, revealing skinny legs encased in thick, yellowing tubes.
Very good, very good, he said. She still sends me these double-knit combinations, silk on the inside, then three layers of wool, reinforced gussets and a couple of handy trapdoors. Very reasonably priced at $6 a pair because I'm an old customer. For it is written, wrap up warm or you'll catch your death.
It's just a trick. Lutse looked surprised.
What?
He said.
Well, I mean, it's all tricks, isn't it? Everyone thinks you're a great hero, and you don't fight, and they think you possess all kinds of strange knowledge, and it's just tricking people, isn't it? Even the abbot. I thought you were going to teach me things worth knowing.
I've got her address, if that's what you want. If you mention my name,
Oh, I see, you didn't mean that, right?
I don't want to be ungrateful, I just thought you thought I should use mysterious powers derived from a lifetime of study just to keep my legs warm, eh?
Well, debase the sacred teachings for the sake of my knees, you think?
If you put it like that, then something made Lobsang look down. He was standing in 6 inches of snow. Lutse was not. His sandals were standing in 2 puddles. The ice was melting away around his toes, his pink, warm toes.
Toes, now that's another matter, said the sweeper. Mrs. Cosmopolite is a wizard with long johns, but she can't turn a heel worth a damn.
Lobsang looked up into a wink.
Always remember, rule one, eh?
Lutse patted the shaken boy on the arm.
But you're doing well, he said. Let's have a quiet sit-down and a brew-up.
He pointed to some rocks, which at least offered some protection from the wind. Snow had piled up against them in big white mounds.
Lutse?
Yes, lad?
I've got a question. Can you give me a straight answer?
I'll try, of course.
What the hell is going on? Lutse brushed the snow off a rock.
Oh, he said. One of the difficult questions.
Igor had to admit it. When it came to getting weird things done, sane beat mad, hands down. He'd been used to masters who, despite doing wonderful handstands on the edge of the mental catastrophe curve, couldn't put their own trousers on without a map. Like all Igors, he'd learned how to deal with them. In truth, it wasn't a difficult job, although sometimes you had to work the graveyard shift. And once you got them settled into their routine, you could get on with your own work, and they wouldn't bother you until the lightning rod needed raising. It wasn't like that with Jeremy. He was truly a man you could set your watch by. Igor had never seen a life so organized, so slimmed down, so timed. he found himself thinking of his new master as the Tick-Tock Man. One of Igor's former masters had made a Tick-Tock Man, all levers and gear wheels and cranks and clockwork. Instead of a brain, it had a long tape punched with holes. Instead of a heart, it had a big spring. Provided everything in the kitchen was very carefully positioned, the thing could sweep the floor and make a passable cup of tea. If everything wasn't carefully positioned, or if the ticking, clicking thing hit an unexpected bump, then it'd strip the plaster off the walls and make a furious cup of cat. Then his master had conceived the idea of making the thing live, so that it could punch its own tapes and wind its own spring. Igor, who knew exactly when to follow instructions to the letter, dutifully rigged up the classic rising table and lightning rod arrangement on the evening of a really good storm. He didn't see exactly what happened thereafter, because he wasn't there when the lightning hit the clockwork. No, Igor was at a dead run halfway down the hill to the village, with all his possessions in a carpet bag. Even so, a white-hot cogwheel had whirred over his head and buried itself in a tree trunk. Loyalty to a master was very important, but it took second place to loyalty to Igordom. If the world was going to be full of lurching servants, then they were damn well going to be called Igor. It seemed to this Igor that if you could make a Tick-Tock Man live, he'd be like Jeremy. And Jeremy was ticking faster as the clock neared completion. Igor didn't much like the clock. He was a people person. He preferred things that bled. And as the clock grew, with its shimmering crystal parts that didn't seem entirely all here, so Jeremy grew more absorbed and Igor grew more tense. There was definitely something new happening here, and while Igors were avid to learn new things, there were limits. Igors did not believe in forbidden knowledge, and things man was not meant to know. But obviously there were some things a man was not meant to know, such as what it felt like to have every single particle of your body sucked into a little hole, and it seemed to be one of the options available in the immediate future. And then there was Lady Lejeune. She gave Igor the willies, and he was not a man usually subject even to the smallest willy. She wasn't a zombie, and she wasn't a vampire, because she didn't smell like one. She didn't smell like anything. In Igor's experience, everything smelt like something. And there was the other matter.
"Our feet don't touch the ground, sir," he said.
"Of course they do," said Jeremy, buffing up part of the mechanism with his sleeve. "She'll be here again in a minute and 17 seconds, and I'm sure her feet will be touching the ground."
"Oh, sometimes they do, sir. But you watch when she goes up or down a step, sir. She doesn't get it exactly right, sir. You can just see the shadow under her shoes."
"Shoes?"
"On her feet, sir," sighed Igor.
The lisp could be a problem, and in truth, any Igor could easily fix it. But it was part of being an Igor. You might as well stop limping. "Go and get ready by the door," said Jeremy. "Floating in the air does not make you a bad person." Igor shrugged. He was entertaining the idea that it didn't mean you were a person at all, and incidentally, he was rather worried that Jeremy seemed to have dressed himself with a little more care this morning. He decided, in these circumstances, not to broach the subject of his hiring, but he had been working that one out. He'd been hired before her ladyship had engaged Jeremy to do his work. Well, all that showed was that she knew her man. But she'd hired him herself in Bart Shoeshine, and he'd got himself onto the mail coach that very day. And it turned out that Lady Lejeune had visited Jeremy on that day too. The only thing faster than the mail coach between Uberwald and Ankh-Morpork was magic, unless someone had found a way to travel by semaphore. And Lady Lejeune hardly looked like a witch. The shop's clocks were putting up a barrage of noise to signal the passing of 7 o'clock when Igor opened the front door. It always did to anticipate the knock. Not did anything, just did. Some things were done, and some things were not done. And the things that were done, Igor's did. That was another part of the code of the Igors. He wrenched it open.
2 pints, sir, lovely and fresh," said Mr. Soak, handing him the bottles. "And a day like this just says fresh cream, doesn't it?"
Igor glared at him, but took the bottles.
"I prefer it when it's going green," he said haughtily. "Good day to you, Mr. Soak."
He shut the door. "It wasn't her," said Jeremy, when he arrived back in the workshop.
"It was the milkman, sir."
"25 seconds late," said Jeremy, looking concerned. "Do you think anything could have happened to her?"
Real ladies are often fashionably late, sir, said Igor, putting the milk away.
It was icy cold under his fingers. Well, I'm sure her ladyship is a real lady.
I wouldn't know about that, sir, said Igor,
who in fact had the aforesaid very strong doubts in that area. He walked back into the shop and took up position with his hand on the door handle just as the knock came. Lady Lejeune swept past Igor. The two trolls ignored him and took up their positions just inside the workshop. Igor put them down as hired rock, anyone's for $2 a day plus walking around money. Her ladyship was impressed. The big clock was nearing completion. It wasn't the squat, blocky thing that Igor's grandfather had told him about. Jeremy had, much to Igor's surprise, for there wasn't a scrap of decoration anywhere in the house, gone for the impressive look. Your grandfather helped to make the first one, Jeremy had said. So, let's build a grandfather clock, eh? And there it stood, a slim, long-case clock in crystal and spun glass, reflecting the light in worrying ways. Igor had spent a fortune in the Street of Cunning Artificers. For enough money, you could buy anything in Ankh-Morpork, and that included people. He'd made sure that no crystal cutter or glass worker had done enough of the work to give them any sort of clue about the finished clock. But he'd worried needlessly about that. Money could buy a lot of uninterest. Besides, who would believe that you could measure time with crystals? Only in the workshop did it all come together. Igor bustled around polishing things, listening carefully as Jeremy showed off his creation. No need for any metal parts, he was saying. We've come up with a way of making the tamed lightning flow across glass, and we've found a workman who can make glass that bends slightly. We, Igor noticed. Well, that was always the way of it. We discovering things meant the master asking for them and Igor thinking them up. Anyway, the flow of lightning was a family passion. With sand and chemicals and a few secrets, you could make lightning sit up and beg. Lady Lejeune reached out with a gloved hand and touched the side of the clock. This is the divider mechanism, Jeremy began, picking up a crystalline array from the workbench. But her ladyship was still staring up at the clock. You've given it a face and hands, she said. Why? Oh, it will function very well in the measurement of traditional time, said Jeremy. Glass gears throughout, of course. In theory, it will never need adjusting. It will take its time from the universal tick. Ah, you have found it, then. The time it takes the smallest possible thing that can happen to happen. I know it exists. She looked almost impressed. But the clock is still unfinished. There is a certain amount of trial and error, said Jeremy. But we will do it. Igor says there will be a big storm on Monday. That should provide the power, he says. And then, Jeremy's face lit up with a smile, I see no reason why every clock in the world shouldn't say precisely the same time. Lady Lejeune glanced at Igor, who bustled with renewed haste. The servant is satisfactory? Oh, he grumbles a bit, but he has got a good heart, and a spare, apparently. He is amazingly skilled in all crafts, too. Yes, Igors generally are, said the lady distantly. They seem to have mastered the art of inheriting talents. She snapped her fingers, and one of the trolls stepped forward and produced a couple of bags. Gold and Invar, she said, as promised. But Invar will be worthless when we finish the clock, said Jeremy. We're sorry? You want more gold? No, 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 you've been very generous. Right, thought Igor, dusting the workbench vigorously. Until next time, then, said Lady Lejeune. The trolls were already turning towards the door. You'll be here for the start, said Jeremy, as Igor hurried into the hall to open the front door, because, whatever he thought about her ladyship, there was such a thing as tradition.
Possibly. But we have every confidence in you, Jeremy.
Igor stiffened. He hadn't heard that tone in Jeremy's voice. In the voice of a master, it was a bad tone. Jeremy took a deep, nervous breath, as if contemplating some minute and difficult piece of clockwork that would, without tremendous care, unwind catastrophically and spray cogwheels across the floor.
I was wondering, your ladyship, perhaps, you would like to take dinner with me, tonight,
Jeremy smiled. Igor had seen a better smile on a corpse. Lady Lejeune's expression flickered. It really did. It seemed to Igor to go from one expression to another,
as if they were a series of still pictures, with no perceptible movement of the features between each one. It went from her usual blankness to sudden thoughtfulness, and then all the way to amazement. And then, to Igor's own astonishment, it began to blush.
"Why, Mr. Jeremy, I don't know what to say,"
her ladyship stammered, her icy composure turning to a warm puddle.
I don't know. Perhaps some other time. I do have an important engagement. So glad to have met you. I must be going. Goodbye."
Igor stood stiffly to attention, as upright as the average Igor could manage, and almost shut the door behind her ladyship as she hurried out of the building down the steps. She ended up, just for a moment, half an inch above the street. It was only for a moment, and then she drifted downwards. No one except Igor, glaring balefully through the crack between door and frame, could possibly have noticed. He darted back into the workshop. Jeremy still stood transfixed, blushing as pinkly as her ladyship had done.
"I'll just be nipping out to get that new glass work for the multiplier, sir," Igor said quickly. "It should be done by now, yes?"
Jeremy spun on his heel and marched very quickly over to the workbench.
You do that, Igor, thank you," he said, his voice slightly muffled.
Lady Lejeune's party were down the street when Igor slipped out and moved quickly into the shadows. At the crossroad, her ladyship waved one hand vaguely, and the trolls headed off by themselves. Igor stayed with her. For all the trademark limp, Igor's could move fast when they had to. They often had to when the mob hit the windmill. Igor's were loyal, but they were not stupid. A job was a job. When an employer had no further use for your services, for example, because he'd just been staked through the heart by a crowd of angry villagers, it was time to move on, before they decided that you ought to be on the next stake. And Igor soon learned a secret way out of any castle and where to stash an overnight bag. In the words of one of the founding Igors,
"We belong dead, excuse me, where does it say we?"
Out in the open, he could see more wrong things. She didn't move quite right. It was as though she was controlling her body rather than letting it control itself. That's what humans did. Even zombies got the hang of things after a while. The effect was subtle, but Igor's had very good eyesight. She moved like someone unused to wearing skin. The quarry headed down a narrow street, and Igor half hoped that some of the Thieves' Guild were around. He'd very much like to see what happened if one of them gave her the tap on the noggin that was their prelude to negotiations. One had tried it with Igor yesterday, and if the man had been surprised at the metallic clang, he'd have been astonished to have his arm grabbed and broken with anatomical exactitude. In fact, she turned into an alleyway between a couple of the buildings. Igor hesitated. Letting yourself be outlined in the daylight at the mouth of an alley was item one on the local checklist of death. But on the other hand, he wasn't actually doing anything wrong, was he? And she didn't look armed. There was no sound of footsteps in the alley. He waited a moment and stuck his head round a corner. There was no sign of Lady Lejeune. There was also no way out of the alley. It was a dead end, full of rubbish. But there was a fading grey shape in the air which vanished even as he stared. It was a hooded robe, grey as fog. It merged into the general gloom and disappeared. She turned into an alleyway, and then she turned into something else. Igor felt his hands twitch. Individual Igors might have their particular specialities, but they were all expert surgeons and had an inbuilt desire not to see any body wasted. Up in the mountains, where most of the employment was for woodchoppers and miners, having an Igor living locally was considered very fortunate. There was always the risk of an axe bouncing or a saw blade running wild, and then a man was glad to have an Igor around who could lend a hand, or even an entire arm if you were lucky. And while they practiced their skills freely and generously in the community, the Igors were even more careful to use them amongst themselves. Magnificent eyesight, a stout pair of lungs, a wonderful digestive system. It was terrible to think of such wonderful workmanship going to the worms. So they made sure it didn't. They kept it in the family. Igor really did have his grandfather's hands, and now they were bunching into fists all by themselves. Tick,